Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, a not-for-profit community credit union now open in downtown Bellevue, serving members at their newest branch at the corner of Northeast 2nd and 108th Avenue Northeast. More information at WSECU.org.
We bought the bar in 2009. It was shortly after I lost my job as a reporter at the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. I got a tiny severance from Hearst, and essentially, the bar we hung out in, I put together a group of partners and we ended up purchasing the bar. So I took my severance and bought myself a minimum wage job.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect, and this is Mike Lewis. He's a journalist and, as you just heard, one of the owners of the Streamline Tavern in Lower Queen Anne.
If you were to look up dive bar in the dictionary, you'd see a picture of the Streamline. It was small and narrow. It was smoky and dark. It was a very old-school Seattle tavern in that no food, beer, and wine, red or white. The problem had been that the neighborhood had gotten younger, it had gotten a little bit wealthier, and people were drinking cocktails, or at least to some degree, a vodka soda, what's called a highball, a drink and a mixer. The neighborhood had shifted that direction. The Streamline had not shifted that direction. And as it turns out, the former owner had stopped paying the rent, which is why we ended up purchasing the bar.
And how did it become clear that that you were going to have to relocate?
Oh, so we purchased the bar, and we did a few things, mainly just cleaned it up, added a full liquor license, and it took off. People liked the fact that it looked like an old Seattle bar, and it behaved like an old Seattle bar. And I remember the day exactly. The landlord tells me that our building was purchased by the South Korean government, and that they are going to build a consulate there, and that they're going to invoke a clause in the lease that evicts us from the bar. So we found a bar on Roy Avenue called Jabu's Pub. And Jabu's was ready to sell. And then we shut down Jabu's, gutted it, because we wanted to take everything out of the Streamline bar and move it down the street.
And when you say everything, what do you mean by everything?
We pulled the paneling off the walls. We pulled all of the booths. We pulled all of the chairs. We pulled the top from the bar surface, out of there, cut it into large segments. We couldn't get a piece of the bar loaded up in a truck. It was too long. It was 22 feet long. So we actually had to hand carry that from the old location. So there's a picture now on the wall of five of us carrying the bar down the street from the old location to bring it into the new location. We took the toilets out and took all the toilets and the urinals to Brown Bear Car Wash and scrubbed them. So we could, but they looked fabulous when we were done.
Why was it important to bring all that stuff?
You know, we felt like we lucked into something pretty unusual in the old place, from this way the bar was shaped to the customers. I mean, Christ, we'd have nothing without them. I mean, we're lucky. We have really good, really loyal customers, and they do more to police the environment than we do. They make sure it's a bar when people walk in. People are friendly to them. I mean, I've always thought of this place as a real soft landing in Queen Anne. And as Seattle has gotten more brittle over time, which is what I feel like it has, a little less accepting, a little more money-oriented over the last 15 years, it's nice to have a place that you walk into that still feels like it's a part of a neighborhood. And it's a place where people hang out. People don't come in here always with their friends because their friends are already here.
A bar can be a pretty special place, a place to be with other people or to hide out from people, a place that holds together neighborhoods and communities in ways that have little to do with actually drinking alcohol. Our theme today is barflies. So sit back, relax, and pull up a stool. It's Sound Effect from 88.5. A bar can feel like a constant in life, something dependable. So it can be a shock when a familiar tavern suddenly closes its doors for good. In December of 2015, a Pioneer Square bar called the Double Header called Last Call for the last time. The thing that makes this more than just another local business obituary is that the Double Header is the oldest gay bar in America. Or one of the oldest, depending on who you ask. Clint Lanier is the co-author of the book Bucket List Bars, Historic Saloons, Pubs, and Dives of America. He visited the Doubleheader in October of 2015, and when he found out that it had closed just a couple of months later, he was shocked that almost nobody was talking about it. It seemed like hardly anybody had noticed. He talked with sound effect producer Kevin Kniestad about the Doubleheader's place in history and why it deserves to be remembered.
The Doubleheader was named that, from what I understand, because of it, it had two floors. The top floor was a tavern, was the saloon, and that's the floor that you walk into off the street. Underneath that was a casino and a pool hall. The casino and the pool hall was, in the 30s, was, I guess, what you could call the gay bar, in the sense of the gay community there was allowed to dance together. You know, so men could dance with men, women could dance with women, and they could dance close and intimately. This place lasted from 1934 to 2015. We went in October of 2015, and it was really just unrecognized. The significance was unrecognized, and because of that, there wasn't a lot written about it. Instead, they just kind of existed as what you could otherwise say was a dive bar. It was dark. You had really old nicotine-stained wallpaper throughout on the empty spots of the walls that you could see. Other than that, it was covered in bric-a-brac with mementos and beer signs and pictures and paintings and so forth.
What did you learn about the original owner, Joe Bellotti Sr.?
Well, Bellotti Sr. was just accepting. He just accepted people for who they were. So he would pay off the cops for his patrons, which is pretty significant. Another thing was that he didn't overcharge anybody, which was also very significant. There were other places where gay people could go, but in most of those places, tolerance was bought by, you know, double price for your beer or for your whiskey. Also, the cops would go there and the patrons would have to fork out money to be left alone. And I can't remember the name of the department, but it's something to the effect of, you know, the Department of Morality or something like that. They actually had these kind of divisions and arrested them for being immoral, basically for dancing together. But Bellotti Sr. did all of this for his patrons. In other words, he paid police to stay away and leave them alone. So they didn't have to fear that when they were downstairs in the casino. And he also never overcharged or gouged anybody. He just kind of ran the place. And then his son, Joe Bellotti Jr., who took it over, I believe, in 1960, was the same.
Do you recall any specifics about any specific stories about any of the photos or things on the wall that jumped out to you that you remember?
There's a photo of a man, probably, I would say, in his 30s, really good-looking guy, who has a normal, very kind of business haircut. And this was in the 80s, and he pointed this picture out to us. The man was wearing a dress and had his legs crossed and was sitting back in his chair, and he said that he was an airline pilot. And every time they would fly into Seattle, he would, you know, had a layover in Seattle. That's where he would spend his time. And that's how he would spend his time, in drag. The guy had a wife and kids, apparently. And to me, the significance of that, it kind of told the whole story of this place, that since the 1930s, the people that went there, the gay community, didn't have to hide who they were in a time when you still had to. And if you think about this particular patron's kind of situation, for all intents and purposes, his public life was meant to fashion himself around who they wanted him to be, right? Who the airline wanted him to be and so forth. But in private, you know, he could be himself when he went to Seattle and he went to the Doubleheader.
You also mentioned earlier, you used the word acceptance when talking about Bellotti Sr. and his patrons. And I feel like that's a different word than, say, tolerance.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. Tolerance means that you are willing to accept something that you don't agree with. And typically, that acceptance is bought, as I mentioned, by gouging the customer, you know, higher prices for drinks or paying somebody off. That's how that tolerance was created. The acceptance that Bellotti has is he didn't care. I don't think he went out of his way to make this a gay bar. He just accepted people. You know, I don't care if you're straight, if you're gay, whatever. You are welcome in this place and you'll be protected in this place because you're my customer. I can imagine that was his attitude at the very beginning. And I can imagine a small crowd, maybe just one or two members of the gay community going there, kind of testing the waters, realizing that he had this attitude and then telling others about it. And so through word of mouth, others started coming. And before long, yeah, it was known as a place where gay people could go and be comfortable and relax. Nobody's gonna mess with them because of Bilotti's just acceptance for who people were, which I think is a much better way to live life than tolerating people.
How did you find out the doubleheader had closed, and what did you think about that?
I have a Google alert for, you know, for bars and saloons and historic bars and saloons and so forth. Nothing hit my radar about this place closing. And so I started looking into it and searching for it, and I found a single blog post. So my feeling was it was disappointment, absolute disappointment that this place closed down, because it had such a great story to tell. It had such a great history to tell. And the other feeling was a bit of shock that nobody seemed to notice or nobody seemed to care that this place just kind of went away. Doubleheader didn't celebrate itself. There was no sticker on the door that said oldest gay bar in America. Nothing like that. The people that knew about it were the people that went there. And to them, it was a place to go and have a quiet drink. And the people that were making that history, the people from the 30s to the 60s, 70s, they were still in the midst of that, right? They were still in the midst of this changing environment for the gay community. And so it might have been a little bit taken for granted that this place was there. And then the next day it wasn't.
Are you surprised when you see places, you know, that you've gone to close a couple years later, and, you know, because, especially when they have some sort of significance or historical significance to its neighborhood? I imagine this isn't the first time something like this has happened where you've seen something with some significance go away. And it I think it's probably a little more common than you might like.
Yeah, it's very common, unfortunately. And when this happens, because I've been there and I know the story and the history, I know what's suddenly lost, right? It's not something that you can ever get back, that the sense of the history and the meaning to a neighborhood. It makes me feel like we're losing touch of who we are. So much of our story was built on what happened in these places, from the labor movement and the formation of unions to so many other things. And these places aren't museums. And to me, that's really significant. If you go to a place like Mount Vernon and you look at where Washington stood or where he slept and so forth, you're doing it all from behind velvet ropes, and you're not allowed into these places. You know, you can look into them, peer into them, but that's about it. Versus a place where George Washington really did go to, that was a public house. And it's every bit as historical as many other places that are roped off. And in a community, when a small neighborhood bar closes, what you're losing is the story of every person in that community that came before the people who live there now. And to me, that's really sad, because these voices aren't going to be back.
Clint Lanier is a professor of English at New Mexico State University, and he co-wrote the book Bucket List Bars: Historic Saloons, Pubs, and Dives of America. He spoke with sound effect producer Kevin Canista. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is barflies. Bars can be many things to many people: a den of iniquity, a dating market, or in the case of Seattle writer Hannah Brooks Olson, an office, a finishing school, and a daycare facility. She shares this essay.
I always joke that dark, divey bars are where I'm most at home, because that's where I first learned how to talk to people. I mean, we learn speech at a young age, on the mats at preschool or at home, mimicking our parents. But forming phonemes is different than really talking to people. most of my life, I've supported myself through talking my way into AP classes, and talking myself out of a trespassing charge when I pretended to be a caterer in order to eat leftovers after a banquet. Talking to people, the kind of talking that I learned in bars and from bar flies, requires a quick wit, sure, but it's also about what you do when you're not speaking. It is impossible to be a good talker without being a good listener. My mom calls it the gift of gab, but I think it's more like the skill of sticky bar top socializing. And I mean it when I say I grew up in bars and that I grew up talking. When I was 2 and 3 years old, my grandfather, a salty old Marine with a majestic mustache, gray and wiry, combed and waxed into a kind of grin on special occasions, used to take me to the bar with him when he was babysitting. I'd hop in his truck, always a Ford, and nothing else. And ultimately, we'd make it to our final destination, the tiny tavern in Eugene, Oregon. A dim and peanut-smelling place, he'd sit me on the bar and put me to work. Tell him a joke, Hannah Brooks. He taught me all of my jokes. With a cloud of curly hair and freckles, I'd charm the patrons and the workers. I had one really good one, my bread and butter, and one that I didn't fully understand until I was at least 10. Why did the chicken cross the road? To show the possum it could be done. He showed me that good conversation is like a river. It just keeps going. I found my way into bars before I was 21. In college, I got a job as a cocktailer at a fancy restaurant. Too young to legally open any of the bottles, I could still serve drinks and wink at the older men and hustle my way to rent. It was a really nice place and a not bad job, but I couldn't quite get the banter down. There's a kind of patience required when talking to rich guys who think they own the world. And because you're in that world, they own you. I don't have that kind of patience. So I applied to work in an all-night diner that's known for its tough love attitude. In my interview, the manager, a greasy little man in gold chains, told me I needed to, quote, have some cojones to work there. I stared him dead in the eye and told him I was a lot tougher than I looked. And I proved it in the face of his relentless sexual harassment. Still, to this day, that was my favorite job. The patrons were crusty, and they expected a little bit of sass. They reminded me of people I knew, people like my dad and my grandfather. Working class older men are my target demographic. I find that they get me, probably because that's who raised me. After blue plate dinners, they'd tip in coins, in cash, and in weed. Occasionally, they'd buy me a shot to do with them, of whatever brown liquor was on the bottom shelf. The day I graduated from college, I worked at the diner instead of walking in a cap and gown that I couldn't really afford to rent anyway. Some of the retired fishermen who'd come in regularly for Friday dinners brought me a balloon and a card and $25. I threw my first and last punch in the alley behind that place because a drunk bully dared me to. He went down like the Titanic. I 86'd a snotty college girl for calling me trashy. I made friends with an old cabbie who'd give me rides at bar close and never let me pay. I'd stash dollar bills in the seats and hope that he found them. And then there were the napkin notes, love notes from drunken suitors, and hate notes from everybody else. Let's go out sometime. Great, but I still have a lot of them in a shoebox. You're smarter than you look, fatty. Once a hunched-over woman wrapped in a scarf wrote to warn me that I had a curse put on me.
I got these demons inside me. come out around this bar. But if you can look past them and just see me for myself, I think that we would get along.
Now I'm 30 and I'm a writer, and that's basically just a different kind of talking. I don't work at a bar anymore, but I work in bars all the time. Most bars, even the really grimy ones, have Wi-Fi these days, and I like to post up in a particularly dark booth and just bang out my assignments. There's something about alternative rock on the jukebox and a frosty PBR that is just conducive to stringing together sentences and finding the perfect word. I think every writer should work in a bar for at least a year, if only to be better at setting scenes. I know a lot of writers who love coffee shops, but they're too bright and too clean, and there's not enough beer. There is something eminently comforting to me about a bar. The low light, the familiar smell of cleaning fluid and stale alcohol and secondhand smoke that's miraculously lasted for more than a decade after the smoking ban. And the fact that there's usually at least one person whose job it is to make sure that everyone's safe. When I was about 22, my grandfather and I went to smoke cigarettes and drink Coors Light in the Goshen Tavern just outside of Eugene. It's the kind of place that still has a hitching post outside, and it was our first time sharing a drink in a bar when I was of legal age. He told me that he liked that bar because it's good to have a port in the storm. I think about that a lot. When I first moved to Seattle and could barely afford to eat, one of my first tasks was finding my port in the storm. I'd stash away $3 for a cheap beer and a tip and go there once a week to catch up on the neighborhood gossip and make myself feel more at home. Even now, whenever I'm traveling, I still look for neon bar lights. I've had a lot of ports in the storm over the years, and I'm always looking for more. I'll still stop into a dark, damp dive with posters of last year's sports schedules and dingy dollar bills pinned to the ceiling, wherever I am. And I'll play pull tabs, and I'll talk to the person behind the counter. Sometimes I'll ask if they've heard any good jokes lately. So if you ever see me at the bar, come say hi. I'd be glad to talk. And if you ask, I might even tell you a good one.
Whiskey, won't you come and take my trouble?
Hannah Brooks Olson is a writer in Seattle.
'Cause I can't seem to do it on my own. In the morning there is hours and infinity. The starlit evenings come to take me home.
Gabriel Spitzer here. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5, and today's theme is barflies. So the scariest bar to walk into in the Seattle area might not be a seedy dive downtown. It might just be a juice bar in an obscure strip mall in Shoreline. What makes a live juice bar so daunting is its owner, Andrew Ho. He's just as likely to curse out and humiliate his customers as he is to soothe their ailments with foamy fruit and vegetable concoctions. Sound Effect contributor Bree Ripley has been a patron, an employee, and a student of Andrew's unusual philosophy on customer service.
This is my friend Najib Amini.
Hi, how's it going?
He's walking into a live juice bar in Shoreline for the very first time, and he has no idea what to expect.
How to order. To help keep costs down, there are no lines. Take your time to decide, but call out your order the moment you decide. Failure to follow will result in you standing around like an idiot. I do that a lot. Interesting.
The rules here are interesting, and the juices are just as intense.
All right, so some of the names, you get your The Exorcist, Green Energizer, Freaky Filled... The Basic Bitch. Oh, that's funny. Carrot and Orange.
If this whole atmosphere sounds familiar, it's probably because you're a Seinfeld fan, and you remember this guy.
Excuse me, I think you forgot my bread.
Bread, $2 extra.
$2? But everyone in front of me got free bread.
You want bread?
Yes, please.
$3! No soup for you.
The Soup Nazi's goal was all about being efficient. But Andrew's motivation for being rude is different. He actually wants to make people meaner. For Andrew, it's a mix of disdain and genuine care.
I've noticed that nice people are more likely to have bad diets. They repress more. Nice people will, for instance, not tell the server that they received a bad meal. They won't tell the person giving them their haircut that they got a bad haircut. They'll suck it in and not say anything. They'll be the person who doesn't want to work over the holidays, but will do so and with a fake smile. That leads to repression of fundamental emotions such as anger and hate.
Najib is looking around. He sees black walls, shrines of Chinese dictators, and a sign that says, "Shoplifters will be tortured and murdered." It's a far cry from Jamba Juice's pastel interior. Now Najib is stepping up to the counter. If he orders wrong, he's going to have to pay a $5 idiot tax.
Do you want a juice, protein shake, or a smoothie? Are you hungry or are you thirsty?
Let's go with the smoothie.
Smoothie? Okay, do the... Give me a kale smoothie. Kale smoothie!
Kale smoothie.
There we go.
I'm trying the kale smoothie.
Najib makes it out unscathed, but some customers don't. Some don't ever come back. The nearly 200 reviews of a live juice bar on Yelp make this clear.
You know, rude. He really is a pig, and, you know, this place is dysfunctional.
Does it ever rattle you?
Not really. I think it's kind of funny.
Do you think it's bad for business?
No, you can always make a bad review good for business. It depends how you work with it. So we had to figure out a way to get them so pissed off that they would screenshot our message and then publish it online on the Yelp. They assumed that nobody could possibly want to go to a place where people respond this way. Well, you're right. 9 out of 10 people don't, but the 1 out of 10 do, and they become very loyal customers.
I'm one of those people who found this place and was intrigued by the totally mixed Yelp reviews. Some people love this place. Others, well, they caution people, telling them to visit at their own risk. Having been a customer since I was a broke college student with a bad sweet tooth, I found a live juice bar on a rare healthy kick, wherein I was trying to do something about all the garbage I was eating on the regular.
The American palate has been narrowed so much so that they can't enjoy anything much more than hamburgers and pizza and hot dogs. American cuisine had become a disaster.
That's Andrew speaking at a Town Hall Seattle event. I started working here just a few months ago. I'm slightly suspicious and mostly curious about Andrew's Spartan attitude towards life and health. He views health as the most sacred part of personhood.
I noticed in the beginning that people would come in on Sundays or Mondays and they'd expect me to play the priest role as they confess their sins to me about what they did over the weekends or the night before. So it could be, you know, half a pizza, an entire pizza, 12 margarita shots, a 12-pack of beer, and so forth. So it wasn't just simply a proprietor and customer. It became priest and parishioner.
Andrew opened the shop 8 years ago with his ex-fiance. In the beginning, it was tough. It was in the middle of a recession. They had $300 in the till, a nearly broken refrigerator, no store name. And even though the shop was tucked conveniently next door to a 24-hour gym, it was out of sight of most car and foot traffic.
If you're forgotten in your new business and you're tucked in a corner of the middle of nowhere, you will die.
But he hasn't been forgotten. Being rude has been a success. And his success with rude is spreading. Now his business has grown to include a dance studio and a thrift store. All of them operate under a so-called bull and repression-free zone with an overall ban on etiquette. You're probably thinking, why on earth would someone run a business like this at all? Like some sort of modern art social experiment. Why treat people rudely? For Andrew, at the end of the day, it comes down to what matters most to him, hostile earnestness. He believes our health depends on it, and so does his legacy.
A customer came in. She told me, oh, I forgot about this place. And at that point, I realize I have to make sure that every customer who walks in never, ever forgets this place. This was early on when we were still young. We were desperate for customers. And I was really pissed off to know that somebody can forget us. So I told myself, I'm going to make sure that nobody who walks into this place will ever forget us. Good or bad, they're going to walk out of there, they're going to be thinking about us. And the only thing worse than being treated poorly is to be ignored. You know, if you're being treated poorly, at least it means you matter.
That story from sound effect contributor Bree Ripley. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is barflies. For better or worse, having a social life in America, especially if you're single, is often closely connected with alcohol. And for a lot of people, that's fine. But for others, about 15 million nationwide, alcohol addiction is a serious problem. People recovering from alcoholism may find they have to figure out how to live a new life, one not so wrapped up in the rituals of drinking. Seattle journalist Erica C. Barnett confronted that dilemma when she gave up alcohol. She explains how drinking was part of the persona that she'd once imagined for herself.
Growing up, I really idolized a lot of writers who were sort of big personalities. I grew up in Texas, and I idolized Molly Ivins, of course, and also people like Hunter S. Thompson, the people that every sort of alternative journalist grows up idolizing. And a lot of those people were really hard living, hard smoking, hard drinking types of characters, hard drug doing. And so that was sort of the type of person that I thought I would grow up to be. And then I started working at a newspaper where I think drinking was a little bit more of the culture. And I really enjoyed it. And I loved sort of feeling like I was in the in crowd. I loved being able to meet with people over drinks just to get to know sources. That is a wonderful way to get to know a source over a couple, 5, 10 drinks. And it just made sense to me that, well, that's what journalism culture is. It's, you know, it's hard drinking. It's you write with a whiskey every night. You do interviews with a drink in your hand. And so that's what I did for about 10 years.
How much of your writing did you do in bars?
I did a lot of writing in bars. I used to, there's a bar over on Broadway that's not there anymore called Septium. And that was my place. And I felt very comfortable there. And I would sit there on, I think it was Tuesday nights, and write my City Hall column and, had knocked back a few vodka sodas and watch people walk by and say hi to people. And that's just, you know, that just seems like a normal way of doing it to me. And to a certain extent, it still does. I don't understand coffee culture or writing in the middle of the day. You know, that just all seems incredibly foreign to me now that I don't drink, and even after several years of not drinking.
So how did it dawned on you that alcohol was becoming a problem for you?
Oh, man. I think it dawned on me when my friends started making jokes about, oh, you're such an alcoholic. And I started thinking, I don't know if I find that word that funny. And when I would write something at Septium, and I would just think, oh, my God, this is the most brilliant thing in the world. And I'd look at it the next day and go, this makes no effing sense. And I started to realize that my writing, instead of having this amazing clarity that I thought that drinking gave me as a writer, it was actually really muddling my writing and making it kind of confusing in ways that people were noticing. And I was, you know, I was making errors. I was just kind of not telling the story with a clarity that I would hope to have. So that was very early on, because near the end, I would say, and for the last few years, I was drinking alone at home. I wasn't going out. I wasn't partying. I wasn't having a good time. I was just a depressed writer sitting at home, slowly killing myself.
So after you got sober, did you take a break from going to bars for a while?
I did. Yeah, I didn't go to bars for probably 6 months. And the AA saying is, if you keep going to the barbershop, eventually you're going to get a haircut. And I don't think that that's necessarily true, but I tried to abide by that at first.
Yeah. What do you remember about when you went back to bars?
I remember feeling very relieved that I felt comfortable there and that I didn't feel the need to drink or the desire to drink. That was kind of an amazing feeling. And realizing that, you know, the having that security in my own sobriety and my own sort of ability to resist something that had really had me in its grip for such a long time was really empowering.
How differently do you see the scene at a bar? You know, like, do you have totally different goggles now than you did then?
I think I do, because I think it's like, you know, it's like I have supervision or something, because I've been, you know, that person and that person, that person. So I think the ecosystem of a bar is really interesting. You have people who are on first dates, you have people who are fighting, you have people who are having a really good time or out for a girls' night or whatever. And I think I perceive that a little more clearly now because I'm not just paying attention to myself. And it really is, for me, it's really fun to be the sober person in a bar, you know, up to a certain point. And what sets me off is when people sort of treat me like a delicate flower, you know. Hey, do you want to get drinks? Oh, God, I'm so sorry. Oh, my God. Oh, I'm so embarrassed. And the whole time I'm just thinking, could you just please treat me like I'm normal? I mean, I know I'm not normal, but I don't need this extra attention. And some of it is me. I mean, some of it is just, you know, me thinking, oh, it's weird to set up a coffee date in the middle of the day. Who does that? You know, all kinds of people. Everybody does that. Like, literally everybody. But to me, that just feels so strange still.
Just out of curiosity, what kind of person do you feel like when you're proposing a coffee date in the middle of the day?
Oh, I feel like somebody who works at the Chamber of Commerce and, like, wears pumps and a suit and, you know, blow dries their hair.
And for people who cannot see you, you are not that?
I am wearing a hoodie and some silver Stan Smiths, and I did blow dry my hair today, but it took about 5 seconds. And yeah, I feel very, very straight world when I do that.
Yeah. Well, is that part of what makes, I mean, addiction is complex, right? But is part of it giving up a certain way of seeing yourself?
That's a really good observation. It is. It's seeing yourself as somebody who has this kind of sexy vice. And I'm not saying that addiction is sexy. That is, you know, a complete misconception of what especially late stage addiction is like. But it is giving up this idea of yourself as like the person sitting in the back of the bar, the last person to leave, a nighttime person, and all the things that that connotes. And thinking of yourself as one of the people that goes to AA meetings at 5 o'clock.
Erica C. Barnett blogs at The C is for Crank. She writes about addiction and recovery in her forthcoming memoir from Viking Books. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is barflies. So back at the beginning of the show, we met Mike Lewis. He's the bar proprietor who physically moved most of the Streamline Tavern, including the urinals, to its new location. Well, Mike's relationship with bars goes back a long time. As he explained from a corner table at the Streamline, bars are a big way that he got to know his father.
He was really a bright guy without a lot of formal education. And he ended up working, he had a car lot in town, and then worked, he and his brother opened up a fruit stand for a while. But he was also a guy, and I think this is where my love for bars started, who loved bars. And I think he loved the community in them. And he spent, you know, I think sometimes maybe too much time there. Although I never felt like he wasn't around. He definitely was a guy who had a second family, if you will, in the bar. And the bar he hung out in is a place called The Ranch.
Would you say he had a drinking problem?
He drank. Drinking problem? I think that there was a couple of periods where he probably drank too much, although it didn't seem to manifest itself. I do remember him one time getting, the one time he hit me as a kid, I was maybe 14 years old, and it was because I'd answered "what" in the wrong tone of voice to my mom. And it just, like, there was one rule you never broke in the household was any level of disrespect to my mom. And he blew up. And I think he had been drinking at that point. But it wasn't like something that we saw as a problem. I mean, my dad was a hero to all of us. And he was a guy who had absolute standards on right and wrong and owning your problems and facing the music when you had to. He drank, I think, what was pretty standard in the day. And it never seemed to manifest itself in any big problems at home.
Did he ever come home with evidence of a fight and that you noticed as a kid?
So, yeah, you'd hear stories. So if you do what most kids do, which is you hang out near where the adults are talking and you listen. My dad would be talking to him about my cousin Vince and the fact that they ended up in a fight in some bar somewhere. And my dad, and I've never been like this, but my dad, I think, enjoyed fighting. And he enjoyed fighting when he had a reason to. He was not a guy who would pick a fight, and he was not a bully. But he was a guy who, if you were bad to a white person, he would stand up immediately and, in his manner, take care of business. And it wasn't like he was a guy I would consider violent. He was just a person who had standards and sometimes would impose those standards on people he felt like weren't meeting them. I struggle with this a little bit because I don't want to make it sound like he was a violent guy. He was like the emotional arm of the family. He was as warm and sweet as anyone I knew. He just did not suffer fools. And so he made us all, and all the kids were kind of like that too. I think maybe that's part of the reason that I augured into journalism, is I didn't like bullies. And I felt like someone needs to stand up for the little guy.
Did he ever take you to the bar with him?
So this is one of my great regrets. I think about this, you know, all the time. Because, you know, it would have been really great to have a beer with him. I'd never got a chance to because I was 21 when he died. I'd just been 21 for a little while. He already had cancer at that point. He was really sick and he wasn't drinking or hanging out in the bar. And so a couple years after he died of cancer when he was the same age I am right now. And the bar he hung out in, the ranch, which is no longer there in Modesto, California, I wanted to go down there and just see what it was like. And I go down to the ranch and I open up the door and it's absolutely exactly what I had expected. You know, it was dingy and dark. And I sat down at the bar and I ordered a beer. And the bartender came over and we chatted a little bit. And there's a few people at the bar, probably maybe 20 people in the room. And then I looked over to the side and I saw a bar stool that had been roped off. And I said, "What's that all about?" And they said, it was for Jack Lewis. And I said, "Really?" And they said, "Yeah, he was a guy who hung out in here. He was really well-liked. He always stuck up for people." And I said, "I was his son." I told them, I said, "I'm his son." And they stopped and said, people started coming over. He spread the word in the bar and they started coming over to tell me about the things that my dad had done for them. So part of what made him a really good man made him a lousy businessman. And he had this car lot where they were cheap cars. This was a used car lot in Modesto, California. So we're talking about $500, $1,000 cars. And he never collected, like, people couldn't make payments on them, right? And he didn't want to take anyone's car away. And so we had all this, you know, junk sitting around the house, riding lawnmowers that only worked in reverse, you know, crazy stuff like this. We had this whole collection of things that people would give him in lieu of payment because he didn't want to take their car back from them because he knew that they needed it to get to work. And so it was this long series of stories. One woman who was there with her sister, and she just talked about how much, she didn't get into any specifics, how much she depended on my dad for straightening out one of her sons. And I don't know, it could have been somebody, because we would have from time to time, I mean, mind you, we grew up pretty poor, but every now and then, you know, I would be cleared out of my room and we would create space for somebody who didn't have a place to go, maybe got evicted or something like that. And so you'd have people living in the house. And that happened from time to time. And I suspect it might have been one of those circumstances. But she went into a fairly long story about him giving her and her family a place to stay when they got forced out of a house. And I went on for 2 hours, 3 hours in the bar that afternoon, and it was amazing. I mean, it was a window into him that I had not, I guess I'd suspected it existed, but I had never actually peered through it. And it was when I actually felt like I got to know him a little bit as an adult.
Yeah. And it makes me think about the way that bars can be seen as a social ill in some ways, right? Because alcohol is in a lot of ways a problem in this country. But at the same time, bars have this salutary, they're the social glue in this very particular low-key way that holds community together in a lot of ways.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. And I'm the first person to admit the social ill associated with. I mean, you know, I fully recognize as a bar owner about the problems that alcohol brings. I mean, I see it all the time. And so I'm not minimizing that. But I will say that you see more people in friendly conversations in a place like this or in another good bar in town, let's just say Targi's up on the hill, you see them more frequently interacting than you do really in coffee shops where people sort of, they go in and isolate. And I think that there's something about being in an environment where you can be shoulder to shoulder with another person. And even if you hear, and especially in a bar like we have here, just given its shape, you inadvertently get pulled into other people's conversations. And that's the way maybe you make a friend, or at the very least, that's the way you feel a little bit more welcome in a city that sometimes doesn't feel like that. And then you create some sort of tiny temporary bond that maybe can build over time into a better one. I think that they are glue. I mean, I think they're a load-bearing pillar in a good town. I think that you get to know a neighborhood through its people, and you get to know its people through where they hang out. And that's how you learn about your community, at least at a neighborhood level. And sometimes that's how you learn about yourself.
That's it for our show today. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestedt, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. Our intern is Janae Janik. We had help today from Hannah Brooks Olson and Bree Ripley. Special thanks to Mike Lewis for helping us shape this episode. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. You can ask your smart speaker to play Sound Effect, the podcast, or just subscribe in the usual places. Give us your feedback on our Facebook page or write to soundeffect@knkx.org. And be sure to join us next week when our theme is The Last Straw. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KNKX.